Welcome back, everybody. We are talking with William Line about occult ether physics, Tesla, man-made UFO technology, and all the related topics that ties into this. And I wanted to get more into the role, I guess, of the government in the last couple of, last few decades then, really, if not even longer, half a century maybe at this point, of what they've been doing and how they've built up things. I mean, again, you have a pretty unique view on the whole UFO field, of the whole, you know, alien question and all that stuff. And just I wanted to kind of ask you a little bit more about that so you can, present those ideas to our audience here a little bit. What's your general view of the UFO field? How this, I guess, from your point of view, how you've seen the mythologization of the alien and the idea of, you know, us believing in that? And tell us more about that.
Well, the whole field was actually created by the government as a counterintelligence field, distribute misinformation. It had two purposes, and it was partly based on the same thing that was done to Nazi Germany. They emphasized the paranormal. The father of the paranormal psychology was Hans Harbiger, who was Hitler's guru in Germany, and they basically used the paranormal stuff to stretch the credulity of the German public so they would accept the big lies. And it's being used here the same way because the same people basically instigated it in this country after the war. And so they basically created the whole UFO field as to, number one, to cover up the UFO secrets. Number two, to stretch the credulity by talking about aliens. You know, basically what this does is this wallows a big hole in the credulity of the average person so that they will believe anything the government tells them. And this has been the whole idea. And I'm a little encouraged by the fact that people are starting to question the government more and more every day, and I think it's about time. But it goes much further beyond what people suspect. You
right.
know, they don't realize that the science books have been distorted and so forth. So they're actually teaching kids scientific garbage, you know, in many respects. But
I don't doubt that at all. It's if we look at the whole field of education overall, it's going down the tubes. But it has there been kind of, as you see it, then a battle of different directions that the scientific field could have taken, but again they've avoided it. I mean, again, there seems to be a split really in the early 1900s. You know,
yeah, the dissenters have basically been overpowered. You know, of course, by the unlimited money and propaganda of the government, because, you know, people like J.P. Morgan, he took over, he had a monopoly of communications. He owned not only the telephone, you know, distribution and power distribution, but he also owned all the radio stations and banks and so forth. So they basically, what I call pops physics is popular physics. Is basically stuff that real physicists don't really pay any attention to that stuff. They don't use relativism in their scientific processes. You know, it's basically just there to brainwash the public. They read the magazines, you know, that this stuff is in. And so, you know, you got all these metaphysical stuff, string theory, and so forth and so on, you know, that lead nowhere. And don't really tell you anything. And they're trying to want to have it both ways. They're now trying to figure out, well, what is this dark energy? And they're saying, well, it might be, they don't want to call it the ether, you know. But there have been some situations which have arisen, which becomes very obvious that there's energy in space. And so they're trying to figure out something to call it other than the ether, because they don't want to make Tesla look like he was right. You
know? But you're saying it's the same thing that's been identified?
To some degree, but they're not going to use it in any practical way. As I say, the energy companies control the government. I mean, the energy and other cartels, they control the government, so the government's not going to step out of line and really give us anything. We have to get it ourselves if we're going to have it, because the government's not going to let us have it.
Right.
So we're in a situation where the government has acquired all this technology as I say, stealing and concealing for a long time. And basically, whereas originally it was an inventor's property, absolute property, they just grab it and force the inventor to accept a payment for it and then sign a non-disclosure agreement. So they'll go to jail if they say anything about it.
Yeah.
And so basically we're in a situation where we have a government that possesses all this advanced technology and we can't have it. So we're struggling along, indebted to the power company and who knows what else, And, we pay through the nose for energy. And meanwhile, let's say in 1900, people's energy bill was pretty low compared to today. And I doubt very seriously if it occupied as much of the a higher percentage of the income of that person,
right,
as it does today. But now it's occupying a pretty strong, percentage as is being spent on, running the car, heating the house, cooling the house, or whatever,
Right.
Getting pretty ridiculous. But we basically, what they've done is they've got teams and teams of physicists and scientists, with high credentials, what I call, I can't remember my term for credulity. It sounded like heightened credulity, because mm-hmm. they've got the credentials.
Right.
And they basically are out there to ridicule anyone who comes up with a theory of anything or even a free energy process. And so these things appear and then they disappear. There's a window of about 2 weeks after these things become known before they disappear. And let's say some guy in India figured out a way to turn water into gasoline with a plant. And lo and behold, after being reviewed by the scientific society in India, they suddenly announced that, oh, no, it didn't work. That sort of thing. Where there's an announcement or a revelation makes it out and then it disappears. Now, in 2001, right before 9/11, in July, the Russian Academy of Sciences made an announcement of a free energy discovery. It involved a kind of a block of silicone material. And it produced high-frequency electromagnetic waves. So you could put an inductor around it and capture that energy. You had unlimited free energy from that device. And it was produced by putting a silica material in a vacuum with a magnetic field and centering it with certain dopants and so forth. And that's how they produced it. And I believe it was produced in response to a recommendation that I had in Pentagon Aliens, because I sent a copy of that book to Volgograd, to an aeronautical student there,
mm-hmm.
and whose mother bought the book, and I sent it to him. And the experiments mentioned in the book. So I think they just carried it out, and then it disappeared. You heard nothing about it after the announcement of the Russian Academy of Sciences. And these are all top-notch scientists. They're all peer-reviewed, well-known internationally that made this announcement. So, they didn't do this it wasn't just a negligent, accidental, occurrence. It actually occurred. So that just disappeared. Well, I wondered if those are the same scientists that were killed in 9/11 who were visiting the Pentagon, the same Russian scientists. And I don't have any verification on it, but I got a suspicion that those guys were scheduled for, getting knocked off,
Right.
And because they'd already made this announcement and they had this information. But kind of things... Go ahead.
Yeah, so they're doing active, not only, ridicule on that level, but actually real removing some of these people that are in this position? I mean, if people are thinking back to something like the, you know, cold fusion experiments of Fleischmann and Pons, we saw what happened there. It seems like this is the standard procedure. I mean, we've seen some differences perhaps with the ECAT stuff that's been going on lately, but nonetheless, it's still very much a poo-pooed science, right? And it's not really
ECAT came from me. It's basically my atomic hydrogen furnace that Rossi had gone out of his way to conceal as the real source of it. And however, it's defective the way he did it, but he got paid off. He's out of the project now. He has nothing to do with it other than he's being called the chief scientist. But other than that, he lives in a retirement condo in West Palm Beach, Florida. And some corporation, which I think was the U.S. Navy, paid him $200 million and took the project. And we'll hear nothing about it from now on. We won't hear about it going on the market or anybody having it and so forth.
So are you saying that it's been taken and then kind of slightly misrepresented so that it's going to give the appearance that it didn't really work as we thought, so, you know, good try. But
yeah, they've already downgraded it by a new test that only produced five times as much energy.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then that's the last that I've heard about it, and probably the last I will hear about it. And then there's the Pons and Fleischmann thing in Utah was also started with me. I had a process that, I had a solar voltaic invention stolen from me. I had the documents that I was preparing for a patent application. And those documents, along with some precious metal that I had, that I'd purified and extracted from ores, stolen from me, and they got the documents and they patented it. And about 10 days later, they filed a patent application on this solar voltaic invention. But when that happened, then I was suspicious of anybody that came around. And this guy had moved into my apartment, and it turns out he was not a spy, but I thought he was at first, you know, because. So I gave him some misinformation about this process that I discovered, where I was trying to dissolve this anode of was basically a lead based anode that I had dissolved precious metals or other. I had no idea exactly what I had in that anode. I still have some of these ingots, and I was trying to dissolve it. Process, you can dissolve it in an acid or other electrolyte, and electroplate one metal out at a time on a cathode. And what you do is you get the scum that falls to the bottom, and you melt that back up to another ingot, and you do the next metal in the series. So I was trying to do that, but the ingot would not dissolve. And I went through this for weeks in this unrented apartment house. It's actually part of my house. It was in the winter, so it was about 40 degrees in there, and this thing wouldn't dissolve, but it started heating up the solution and boiling it even. And I was only using 3 watts of current, 6 volts at one half of an amp. So that 3 watts current were boiling a 5-liter container of electrolyte. And I couldn't pick that beaker up without, insulated gloves. It was so hot. And I was only 3 watts of current. Well, I had no idea what was in the anode. I still don't know. I know that it's got lead in it. It's got a few other metals in it, apparently. And probably has antimony, probably has some tin in it, I don't know. It's just, it's unknown. You know, I dissolved some of these metal concentrates, and I was trying to purify them.
Right.
So so this new guy came in. He wanted to rent an apartment, and he was curious about these energy processes, and I thought he was a spy, so I gave this information to him. But I told him that the anode was actually palladium. And this man was an American Indian whose mother was a Pima, and she was a Mormon who lived in Salt Lake City. So he went up there to visit her, and he gave the information to these guys at Brigham Young University, and that's how the information got to Pons and Fleischmann, and then they began to develop the process and what we call cold fusion. And actually, the reason I said palladium is I knew palladium would have some interesting reactions that would drive. I wanted to drive them crazy. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to drive the experiment, the thieves, crazy by giving them misinformation. So I came up with the idea of telling them that it was palladium. And consequently, a lot of people have probably gone crazy over that project, but it actually produced some useful energy, apparently. But I believe it's just atomic hydrogen process. I don't believe it's cold fusion. And just like Rossi tried to say that this process that's based on mine was cold fusion, it's basically atomic hydrogen process. And he uses heated electrical wires, resistant wires, to dissociate hydrogen, and then he pumps that into some nickel powder, and then the reaction is there. It cuts down on the temperature so that it doesn't melt his apparatus, and then he produces some energy, but he doesn't get the kind of results that are obtainable if it's done properly. But he had to do something to make it look different and try to describe it differently, you know, in order to show that he wasn't, to try to make it appear that he wasn't just stealing this idea from me, because part of my book was published in Italy by a group of experimenters there. I gave him permission to do it. And that's how he got his hands on the material, and then he experimented with it and came up with a false, description and so forth. And
all right.
I'll hand him. There's some uniqueness to it, I believe, because of the way it was designed. But what do you expect? The guy was trained as a relativist, you know, just like the rest of them. So he couldn't possibly come up with the real thing, you know.
Tell us more about the conspiracy of relativism and what you see happen there with, you know, Einstein and Boscovich, and then Tesla's kind of other type of science on top of that, which was neglected pretty much.
Well, Boscovich was a Croatian Jesuit priest, and so consequently, because Tesla was from that part of the world, he'd heard about Boscovich, who was known more for his books, his prose. He wrote quite a few books that were popular, you know. But he was actually the discoverer of what we call the relativist theory, and which was based on a religious concept, the immateriality of the soul. But it has all the features of relativism in it. You know, instead of quanta, they describe points of light. So basically, Boscovich was already kind of reviewed and rejected by Tesla, you know, already. So when somebody comes up with Einstein, he says, oh, well, don't tell me about this. I've already heard about it from Boscovich, you know.
Right.
And because Einstein's wife was actually a Serbian scientist, a physicist. So that's probably where Einstein got the information. There were some alterations and so forth, but it's still basically a religion. That's the reason I call it the occult science dictatorship, because it's basically a religion.
Right, right.
And these people don't want to give it up after they studied for years and years to learn all that math and so forth that goes with it, which is basically, you know, it's like, you know, proceeding logically from an illogical concept, you know. you know, they don't want to give that up. They've spent so many years learning it, now to find that it's all false. They don't like that. You know, even Einstein said, "Have we built a house of cards?" You know, and he started entertaining an ether theory again toward the end of his life. And his friend Paul Dirac, to Einstein's satisfaction, proved the existence of an ether with mathematical formulas and so forth. However, it's not a mathematical formula. You know, just basically the ether has to exist when you look at all of the things around it.
Tell us more about that, of the makeup or the proof for its existence.
Well, for example, Tesla's idea of environmental energy, you know, my atomic hydrogen process has already proven that there's energy in the environment. There's no other explanation for where the energy is coming from. You use the hydrogen just as a medium to get this reaction, but it doesn't use the hydrogen up. It doesn't disappear. So you're still getting this energy, and you circulate it in the process. You dissociate it, put it back together, and it produces radiation, which produces heat, and then you use it again. You dissociate it again, and you do this over and over ad infinitum. And so, you know, basically, you have to have something in space. You can't transmit, for example. They call the ether the luminiferous ether, because it carried the ether carried light. So you can't transmit light as a wave through anything but a solid. But you can carry it as a I'm seeing what I think might be a UFO right now.
Oh, really? Tell us what you see.
Yeah, but it's moving behind some trees now through a window. It's moving too slow to be an airplane, and it's not a helicopter. So it just happened to, the sun just happened to glint on it, and there it was. But anyway, get back to this. I see them quite often sometimes if you keep your eyes on the sky.
Right.
But anyway, this idea, you see, between the it's all between the solid ether and the gaseous ether. The solid ether was necessary in order to prove Maxwell's equations. Maxwell was basically a relativist. He believed in a solid ether, and he believed that electromagnetic waves could be transmitted through free space. And Tesla said, no, what you're seeing is what radio waves are is sound waves in the ether, and light is sound waves in the ether. So light is being transmitted, the energy of light is being carried by the ether. Light itself isn't traveling anywhere. There's no particles moving through space. What you have is a waveform that more or less is a standing waveform in the ether that's carrying this energy through space, and where it collides with solid bodies, you know, to produce reactions such as heat and reflection of other wavelengths. And so, you know, you can explain the whole thing with this sound waves in the ether theory. And so all of these guys, you know, all these guys on the other side of the fence that believed in Hertz waves were wrong, because they believed that these were transverse waves and going through space. And that's what the whole, what we call radio science, is all based on a fallacy. And Tesla's radio equipment seemed to work better than anything anybody else did. He designed a number of radios in the 20s and 30s that produced beautiful sound. You know, the early car radios, some of them just really hummed. I had an old Ford that had one of those things in it. And it just produced a hum that you don't get from radios today. So it was
picking up on that, or?
Yeah, it was based on Tesla's theories of the ether, and so it had a more pure, production of sound and so forth, and radio waves. Whereas if you use the other theory, you get defects. But you're still producing sound waves in the ether.
Right.
The radio transmitters that are built incorrectly still will produce the sound waves in the ether. They're just not as pure as Tesla's sound waves in the ether. And if you use Tesla's method instead, you'll come up with a better result. And I think that there are breakthroughs being made in electronics today based on Tesla theory, which some of these people are actually using, and they're not telling anybody about it because they appear to be using Tesla technology.
So if we could, let me ask you this, if we could tap into the ether then, and you say, you know, some people have done that already successfully, but is it a matter of, you know, extracting the energy from that, or I mean, is it a non-depletable source if we manage to successfully? Yeah, go ahead.
The ether is just a carrier. It's not a producer. It, right. Basically, you have to get energy that's been put into it, out of it. And you can get this from, like, sunlight, which is like sound waves in the ether. You can convert that into electrical current. And if we really exploit this concept of the ether, there's no telling what other discoveries we'll come up with. And what we're basically doing is rediscovering what Tesla already discovered, because the government's hiding this stuff. So what we're trying to do is just reconstruct what Tesla already discovered. And, you know, the whole potential is a whole, you know, it just opens up a whole new field, you know, when you
right.
start thinking about this in a different way. And you realize this energy's there, and there's energy being produced. What Tesla called primary solar rays were very powerful particles that were projected into space from bodies like the sun and other stars. And then these collide with bodies in space and create secondary radiations and sound waves in the ether. So there are all these sound waves in the ether traveling right through us and all around us that we can, if we use the right technology, we can extract that energy. And that's what I believe the atomic hydrogen furnace is doing, is it's extracting some of this environmental energy in sound waves in the ether that ultimately comes from stars. Now, I have identified something that I think is interesting, that if you take a weaker force and you convert it to a stronger force, you can do more work in the same period of time. And, of course, gravity is a weak force. The electromagnetic force is much stronger. If you convert gravity into electromagnetic force, you can do more work in the same period of time. And the energy is just what you had with the original gravity. So this is something I think that takes place in nature, so that the weaker forces are converted automatically, or, you know, naturally converted into stronger forces, and that makes up for all the energy that's depleted by friction and other, you know, extraneous drainages on this energy that's available to us.
Hmm.
So we can never run out of it, and we don't need a Big Bang to explain this energy. It's ridiculous. I mean, the Big Bang is silly. It's just, it's like something some little kid dreamed up, you know.
How do you explain origins?
I don't think there was an origin.
Right.
I think it's hard for people to get their minds around this idea that there never was an origin. There's the existence has always existed.
Right.
You couldn't have a point where it didn't exist. It couldn't come into existence out of nothing, because there's your basic theory, you know, there.
Sure. Yeah.
Is that, you know, you have to have something to begin with. So it never originated. It'll never end. And what we see maybe as a, you know, a shift in the red spectrum as some sort of proof of a Big Bang is actually maybe a shift in the red spectrum in our spot in the universe. You know, we couldn't really say what exists beyond a certain point, because millions of years have passed since that event took place. And so we don't really, you know, to say that that the universe is expanding, well, that's kind of like there are expansions and contractions taking place in the universe, I'm sure, all over the place. But for every expansion, there has to be a contraction somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly, that the universe is kind of winding down, right? That was one of the ideas.
Well, that was their idea, and that I don't believe that's true. I think that's ridiculous.
Right. Yeah.
And I also think the Earth's a lot older than they say it is, because of what I explain in my book about the process of how the Earth's mass was accumulated in the first place, very slowly, you know. And I don't believe that the center of the Earth is a ball of iron, molten iron. That's another silly idea, I think. And I don't think that, you know, because you can't produce something from nothing, you couldn't produce heat just by the fact that things weigh something. You know, the Earth maybe weighs a lot, and as it accumulates more and more mass, it can't just continue to produce heat just because it weighs more. You know, somewhere along the line, you have to have a compression and a decompression of that mass in order to produce heat. It couldn't just continue to produce this heat and have a molten ball of iron in the middle, you know, without boiling on the surface. If you had, you know, it's just a matter of thermodynamics. If you had a ball of molten iron in the center of the Earth, that would radiate up toward, you know, through the mass above it, all the way to the surface, and we would have molten, the Earth would be melted on its surface. And it's just ridiculous ideas like that. Plus, you would have no magnetism in the molten iron.
Right.
So the Curie point, you know, you have to worry about that.
Now, let me ask you, let's go back a little bit more here. I wanted to ask you more about the concept of that the sightings we see are not aliens. I think even you stated somewhere that, okay, it's, you know, in regards to alien, you're not saying that it's, you know, impossible for them to exist or intelligent life to exist elsewhere in the universe. It's just you're questioning the basic idea if they've, you know, been here and all that. And I guess you come to that conclusion because of what you speculate when it comes to, you know, abductions, what we've learned through, you know, hypnosis, what people are saying about hybrids and mutilations. There's a number of these factors, right? And so how has this field been created as you see it, and what is the involvement from the, you know, CIA and the government, and how are they using it?
Well, one experimenter at Harvard, for instance, who was an understudy of the guy who worked for the CIA, he hypnotized students who were known to have sleep disorders, and he exploited these sleep disorders to make them have you know, hypnagogic hallucinations that they were seeing aliens. And, you know, all the people describe being paralyzed when they're having this, when they're seeing these aliens. Well, that's called sleep paralysis, and it's part of narcolepsy. It's one of the symptoms of narcolepsy, is sleep paralysis. We're paralyzed anytime we have REM sleep, which is anytime we're dreaming, basically. So they're basically exploiting these people with sleep disorders, and they advertise for them in the paper, bring them in, pick out the ones that are gullible and use them for a project to prove that people are being abducted. You know, but they all see the image of an alien as it's been shown to them. Somehow it's been suggested what this alien is supposed to look like. And so it's just using trick, you know, hypnotherapy or whatever, you know, to create this effect, just to create, you know, it's all CIA propaganda. The original guy who taught this professor was Martin Orme, who went to University of Pittsburgh after he left Harvard. And the professor was John Mack, and he almost lost his PhD because of this project, because, you know, look at what he's doing. He's abusing these patients, you know, and, you know, just to create propaganda for the CIA's misinformation network. And this is this type of stuff, you know. I mean, this is, you know, I show some of this stuff, how it works in occult science dictatorship. I go back to one of the old projects, which was admittedly a government project. And Project Blue Book was a CIA project, for example.
Right. Yeah,
and then there was a Project Lure, which is a CIA project, and this was to make people, you know, think they're going to lure aliens down by putting a bunch of weird symbols on the ground or something, you know. And so here you have, you know, all these people have credentials, you know, to impress the public, PhDs, high military rank, so forth and so on. This is supposed to impress people and make them believe it. And but, you know, it's just a trick. You know, people have to understand that. The aliens, if they're, you know, let's say an alien was on a habitable planet, well, that would be, oh, what, a couple of million light years away. So what do? They invent something called a wormhole to try to, you know, explain how they could get here, you know, in time to still be alive, and so forth. So, you know, they come up with all these crazy theories of physics which are designed to enhance these false, this misinformation network, basically.
So if we look at it from the other point of view, even with the ether technology and the current development of the UFO, man-made UFO, is any of that type of traveling from, you know, the vast distances in a short amount of time possible?
Not really. I mean, you can only go from A to B in so short a time. You know, you can go, I don't know, like I say, I witnessed one going, 36,000 miles per hour. But that's nothing, you know, compared to the speed of light. And if you went at the quarter of the speed of light, a particle the size of a grain of sand would totally destroy a ship. It's just a matter of, that's physics for you.
And there's no protection or anything that's built up because of the energy or, you know,
well, there might
shields.
Be some way that they could make a little particle like that get out of the way, but you couldn't get an asteroid to move out of the way, you know.
Right, yeah.
You can only, you know, you can only take that so far. You could, you know, like they make the air and the atmosphere move out of the way so that the UFO doesn't burn up. I mean, at 36,000 miles per hour, that UFO that I saw would have been burned to a crisp by the oxygen. And so they had to move it out of the way for that ship to fly through there. And that was in 1953. And my mother witnessed a bunch of them in 1950. Hovering over our town, and they were there for 45 minutes over 2 days. There was 15 minutes one day, 30 minutes the next day, two of them one day, one of them the other day. And so there was 45 minutes of viewing time of these UFOs, and I was in the Davis Mountains 120 miles away, so I didn't see them. But my mother described the ships she saw as looking like the bobbin on her sewing machine, if you know what that one of those looks like from
no,
those old
actually,
sewing machines.
I don't, but...
it's like a little bright metal, like a spool, but it's curved a certain way, and it's bright metal, and has a slot around it, you know.
All right, yeah.
So that's the way she said they looked. And so, you know, that was a certain type of German UFO has been described as looking like that. So that was consistent with the descriptions of some German UFOs. 1950, you know, that's only 5 years after World War II, you know, so these things evolved, you know.
Yeah, where are they today, do you think, in terms of, I mean, do they have a whole arsenal of these things? They're building up more and more all the time and advancing the technology?
They have new ones that they're building, and they have old ones from World War II. They have some of the old ones still around. They don't wear out. You know, they can keep these things in hangars, but they apparently are hiding them underground. And they have mountains, for example, that can open up. You know, they have they hire artists to put camouflage over it that looks just like the mountain. And then there's these huge doors that can open up and let these things come out and go back in. And so they also can hide them under a lake, but they're not actually in the water. They go into the water, but then they're pulled up above the water line by some sort of mechanical gadgets to put them in a hangar underground. So they hangar these things underground, or, you know, I believe they've got them in a hangar on a ranch near me, in huge barns that are designed to look like barns for cattle ranch, but the barns are way too big for any cattle ranch barns, so that's a dead giveaway. Plus, I've seen the ships going to and from that ranch. And
what are they? Why are they flying around with them? If you know,
they're just
testing.
What
or
they
is it...
do is they just come up with incessant new projects to test on them. You know, incessant new uses. You know, let's say surveillance in Iraq. They might use them for that. And they can hanger them here and fly to Iraq every day to do their work. You know, because the speed is so fast. You know, it doesn't take them very long to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't take much energy. The UFO is basically a free energy invention, and it uses this.
And they're using it for these kind of mundane tasks, if you will.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Yeah, they're using them for surveillance and other experiments like cattle mutilations, which is really cattle dissections. What they're really doing is they're using a particle beam weapons on the UFOs, which is one of the few weapons they're able to use on them. So they can use particle beam weapons, test them on cattle, which are similar to humans, to figure out how to kill people without leaving any evidence that the person's been murdered. So basically they can kill anybody and you can't prove they were murdered, you know, because there's no evidence. They die of pneumonia because their immune system's been wiped out by ultraviolet light. So they can use ultraviolet lasers, they can use, and they tune these things so that there's no evidence left. That's what the experiments are all about. They basically have airborne labs in these things where they have taken cattle, for instance, that have been checked by a veterinarian and been given a bill of health that shows that they have absolutely no pneumonia in their systems. 2 days later, they're found dead dying of pneumonia, terminal pneumonia. So basically, all their blood is gone, and certain parts are removed to check for ionization. So what they're doing is they're developing a method for murder, you know, call it stealth murder, and where there's no evidence that anybody's been murdered. That person just died of pneumonia. Of course, you wipe out ultraviolet light, will wipe out all of your immune cells and your oncogenes, and you will die of MAI, Microbacterium arum intercellulare, which are soil bacteria. We carry these things in our system, but if our immune systems wipe out, they take over and we die of pneumonia, terminal pneumonia. And this, of course, is what a lot of the AIDS patients die of, when their immune system's been severely compromised. And ultraviolet light will do that and will give you cancer. And that's a nice weapon that the government's using on UFOs. And you have no protection from it, basically.
No.
Except.
Finish that point. Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, the only protection you have is maybe thick walls or whatever, you know, metallic surfaces and so forth.
Right.
It could stop the ultraviolet. And they were testing one of these things on me, and I think maybe trying to kill me with it. That's what I was interviewed about by the Jesse Ventura group. But they didn't get my true story in the thing that was aired. They missed it. This thing was only about 100 yards away. It was only about 300 feet. And it was flashing, and it took me a while to realize that it was actually shooting a beam at me, ultraviolet, because I was getting headaches. And the headaches are a result of seeing ultraviolet light. That'll give you a headache. So I would get these sicknesses that would last for about 4 months. And I realized they were irradiating me, so I moved to a different part of my house to get away from them. This was going on a regular basis when I was writing these books. When I was writing the second edition of Space Aliens from the Pentagon, I was being irradiated, and I was really sick for 4 months after that. That's when I moved to a different part of my house, when I realized that they were actually shooting this beam at me. And then I found out in 2009... that these ships were actually coming from that ranch over there, which is only about 9 miles away. So, you know, I saw the ships going to the ranch and coming in and going out and so forth. And then I realized, well, there's something to these stories. There are these people that lived over in the community of Galisteo who were trying to find the Palladian alien UFO base over there, and they wanted to know if I could get them in that ranch. And then I thought, well, these people are just nutcakes. But actually, they were seeing these ships. That's what they were seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, you know, subject to all that propaganda. They were believing all this propaganda the government's putting about aliens.
So is your conclusion then that when we see, for example, sightings over, you know, nuclear weapons sites and facilities, then the consequent shutdown of those, that there have been the same kind of sightings and consequent shutdowns on airports in China, Japan. I think now most recently we had one in Bremen in Germany. Is that for display then?
Public
display? Okay, what's the reason for that?
Well, they all get together. They want to hide the technology. You figure the Chinese Communist state, they wouldn't want the Chinese citizens to have a UFO. Just like North Korea wouldn't want them to have it, you know, because then people could fly out anytime they wanted to. People could travel anywhere in the world they want to travel. You know, imagine what problems they'd have with customs officials, with people flying everywhere in UFOs. So all of these things are a nightmare for the statists in the world, you know, the people that want to control everybody, whether they're communists or fascists. They all want to control people, and they don't want something in the hands of the public that would allow people that much freedom.
Oh, certainly. No, I understand that. I guess what I was getting at that is that what we're seeing, what we're witnessing is almost the display of the technology in certain sites. It's like,
here we are, kind of thing,
right? So how
it's
does
kinda,
that...
It's kind of funny when the government denies their existence, you know, when so many people are citing them, you know.
Well, exactly. And so is that the building up of the mythology again, do you think? So that they're trying to urge on, like, this idea that, yeah, these are aliens, it's not our ships. Is that the main motive?
It's totally insane. Aliens come here because they don't want us using nuclear energy, you know. I mean, it's a stupid, you know, scenario.
Or nuclear weapons, I guess it was. But
yeah, nuclear weapons, you know. Mm-hmm. And so they're coming over here and shutting down our nuclear weapons production. You know, that doesn't happen, you know, unless the government wants it to happen. You know, I mean, it's something the government would do. They'll go to any lengths and spend any amount of money to conceal this technology. There's no limit. They've got all our tax money to do anything they want to with. And they don't have enough money. They can run the printing presses, and they got more. So,
yeah,
you know, there's no, you know, since all of their corporate interests are tied up in the archaic technology, any money they can spend is well spent if they can cover up this technology with any kind of ridiculous scenarios, you know. And we hear, well, they shut down a nuclear plant. Well, where did you hear that information? You have to question the source of the information. If they could do all that, why would they allow something like the explosion at Fukushima, you know, and allow all this nuclear stuff to leak out and poison everybody? That doesn't make a lot of sense. That's not cost-effective for propaganda. So, you know, there are many pitfalls to their method, and in the end, they will fail as the Scottish poet Robert Burns said, the best laid plans of mice and men will go astray, you know.
Right.
And
do you think that we're seeing a build up or a construction of a new religion around this to a certain extent?
Well, there are some people that theorize that this is a new religion, you know. And then there are some people that think, well, they're going to have a fake alien invasion and have a fascist world state, you know. Well,
sure.
You know, I think they already have it. I think we already
yeah.
have a fascist world state.
I wouldn't argue with that point.
And I believe we've had it for many years. I mean, my experiences show that we have a fascist world state and we've had it for many years. And why would they want to rock the boat when they have everything the way they want it?
Sure.
They got the world by the cojones, and they're not going to turn loose, you know, by having something that's going to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. You know, the goose that laid the golden egg is all the wonderful methods they've set up to control all the money and everybody in it and everybody in society. And a fascist world state would stop that. So you wouldn't have all that money. You wouldn't have all that production. If people were locked down, you wouldn't have all the money. You wouldn't have all the things to all the you know, all the productivity of all the people. You know, they're being enslaved by this.
I guess one of the points that's been argued on top of that as well is just what you said before, but they have all the money at their disposal. So at this point, it's not even about the money anymore. It's about the control of the people within that system. And they, as you said, they could still turn on the printing presses when they want, or devise something which basically has enables them to be live outside of the realm of the monetary finances as we are, you know, tied to it by. So it's all very, in that regard, relative in terms of where you're at in the hierarchy. But what do you see then is the ultimate kind of purpose, I guess, of this and where that is going? You mentioned, for example, that there's been less sightings recently. What's the reason for this, and how will this develop, do you think, in the future?
I think they're basically trying to go back to the old idea that, oh, it's all a fantasy, they don't exist, you know. And, you know, if a person hasn't seen one, pretty soon all the people that have seen them will be dead, and there'll be nobody left around that's actually seen one, you know, or they'll be ridiculed for even saying it. Most people don't even want to say they've seen one when they've seen one because they're afraid of being ridiculed. My own father was helped for about a half an hour by one of these ships over his car in Level M, Texas, 1957, and he didn't talk about it when he came home. He went to the Ford house to have his lights fixed, and so I turned on the morning news, and I heard about the sightings in Level End, people being held hostage in their cars by these things hovering over the cars. So I went down to the Ford house, and I confronted my father. I said, "Why didn't you tell me about the UFO?" And he said, "Well, I didn't want to be called crazy." You know, this thing hovered over his car, killed his engine, burned out all of his headlights and taillights. But not a fuse was blown in the car. So he had to drive back to Level End, spend the night in a motel, then get up at the first early light and drive back down to Odessa, Texas, you know, because he was on a sales trip. And so, you know, here he'd been helped by this thing hovering right over his car, just a few feet above it. Big X-shaped Chinga. You know, and apparently there were a number of other people that had the same experiences or similar experiences that same night. And so I think, well, this is a staged sighting. You know, the government sends these things out to freak people out, you know, and just create a lot of controversy, and people will argue about aliens, you know, talk about aliens and so forth. Just basically to cover up the technology and to stretch the credulity. You know, condition people to accept the big lies. That's half of the thing right there.
Right, yeah. And you said in your book as well that they have made extensive studies on human psychology, religion, you know, mysticism, mythology, well, folk tales, and all that stuff connected. And you see that that's ties into it, right?
What went into the creation of the Third Reich. That was all done through the Tavistock Institute of Britain, financed by the Rockefellers. So the Rockefellers designed the Third Reich and the mass psychology technology, and they trained, you know, the SS in this technology, and they used it on the Germans just to see if it would work. You know, I think Germany, Nazi Germany, was a big experiment, and the work product of all those experiments became the possession of the United States and England after the war. So it was just a big project, you know, to see how far they could control the world, and, you know, and so basically what they did was they created the United Nations after that, and then let's just spread this whole process to the world and make everybody think it's a wonderful thing for mankind. And but I don't see the UN doing anything to stop mass murders in Africa. I thought that's a little conspicuous.
They're shipping in their food bags of rice, you know.
Yeah.
that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, it's a tremendous mess in the world. I don't think anyone can really argue with that. And there's a lot of components to why we are in the mess we're in. And it has to do with everything from conspiracy to personal responsibility. That's definitely for sure. But before we begin to wrap things up for this time, William, I have a couple of more questions for you. Where do you think we will be with the free energy device question, the development of anything that could you know, liberate that technology for us? I mean, people have speculated if people get on top of it, they begin to develop it on an open source basis, or the more and more people make it in their homes and start using it and teaching others how to do it, that would be one of the ways it could be prevented from being stopped from a central point of view with batons and everything else. What do you make of that?
It all comes down to this. If enough people do it at the same time, they won't be able to stop it. You know, if enough people get enough information, valid information, not some cockamamie stuff that doesn't work, but if enough people get enough information and do it, and everybody does it all over the place, the government won't be able to, you know, they won't be able to stop it without being obvious about it, you know. And just a matter of time before somebody develops something that's practical, you know, that people, you know, it's all going to come down to creativity. And, you know, these ideas are going to have to find their way to the public one way or the other. And if we get somebody like Edward Snowden, he was like a hero. You know, if we get somebody in the energy field who knows, some of the stuff that Snowden has may relate to this. And that may be really why they're out to get him like they are, is because he's got stuff that they really don't want us to know about. And you figure you have to ask what is so important about what the man has. You know, I mean, there's no telling. Really makes you wonder. And you know, if the public can get their hands on just, you know, one fraction, you know, of what the government is hiding, you know, we can all, you know, write our own checks, you know. But it's I don't think anybody can escape from the idea that we seem to be reaching a nodal point here, you
mm-hmm,
know.
Mm-hmm.
That there seems to be a point where something's got to give.
Right.
And you know, somebody like Snowden has kind of, you know, they want to make him, they want to crush him to make you know, an example out of him to anybody that has the same idea. But many people believe that he should be rewarded for what he's done because of the fact that he let us know that the phone company's been bugging our phones for, you know, for years.
Well, exactly. Well, I mean, it's been...
I've known about it since 1967.
Well, exactly. I was just going to say that. I mean, certainly, okay, it's great that it comes out to the masses in that regard that it did, but it's for those who've been paying attention, it's frankly nothing new. I mean, this is what NSA is for. That's what they built their multi-million dollar data center facilities up in Utah. That's what this is, you know?
Well, all phone calls have been recorded in the United States since 1967. The only thing that's changed is the storage capacity.
Yeah.
They used to have to cycle them off after 2 weeks. They could only hold a phone conversation for 2 weeks. Now they can hold them indefinitely because they've got enough storage capacity.
Yeah.
So they can go back 10 years ago and get your phone conversations.
And they can search, I think, pretty easy for the data as well, finding the keywords and, you know, stuff like that. So,
Yeah, they can find information. And that's how suddenly you can't figure out somebody. How does the government know what you're thinking? You know, because they're bugging your phone and somebody's reading it, you know. So
yeah,
you know,
it's more than that. In these days, they're getting actually it's intrusion into the devices, into your home, the computer, the dishwasher, the fridge, depending on if it's so-called smart devices,
well,
you know, the TV,
the
phone, and everything else.
The phones could be bug your whole house.
Sure,
you know, while
sure.
They're on the hook.
Yeah.
They could tune it to different parts of your house to get more information. And so, you know, they can drive by in a car and bug your house with your telephone.
So what do you think is the measure against this? And will the system that's been built up, will it crumble under its own weight, collapse if people speak up against it? How will it be cracked, do you think?
Well, I believe the only way we can get things back to normal is take the money away from the powers that be. As long as they've got unlimited money, they're going to do everything they can to take more and more of our freedom. Because that's the nature of the beast. You know, they always want to impress somebody, their bosses or whoever, with all the new breakthroughs and so forth. And the corporations want to sell more of this technology to the corporations, to the public sector, you know, to the government. They want to sell this stuff and they want to make money. And so they devise more and more ways to spy on people. And it just keeps invading more and more of our freedom. And then the next step is a police state, you know, which inadvertently comes about as a matter of natural process because of all the stuff that they have, you know. And so, you know, if we take the money away from them, the corporations will lose power. That's where the big problem is. The corporations have too much money, and individuals and people, ordinary people in society, are getting poorer and poorer. So something has to change this equation. You know, it can't go on like this forever. Because sooner or later, you know, as I say, I'm going to kill the goose that laid the golden egg.
Right.
And the way they look at it, oh, we don't need any more creativity. We don't need any more inventions. We got enough inventions stored up in our vaults to last us for the next 1,000 years.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so we can now just enslave the human race. We don't have to use them to think anymore. We don't want anybody to think. We can create a whole race of humans that don't even know how to think.
Well, and unfortunately, it seems to be heading in that way, in that direction.
Yeah, and we can all just go do some rote job, you know, be slaves.
Yeah, I think there will be a organic, natural rebellion, if we can call it that, against this type of activity, and more people will, you know, choose a different route, walk away from the media, from the propaganda, from the scientific dictatorship, and all that stuff. And I still feel, I feel positive about it. I hope it's going to turn, you know.
Well, I think, you know, Monsanto was deeply seated all over the world, you know, and people don't realize that they buy up energy secrets. And I know a person who sells energy secrets to him. He acquires them, goes around and gets these secrets and sells them to Monsanto. And they pay a lot of money for him to come and demonstrate one of these things. And if it works, they pay him a lot of money. And if it doesn't work, they give him a chance to come back and try it again.
Right.
They pay him by the minute, you know, a lot of money. And then they hide the technology, and that's the last you hear of it. And so it's like a black hole of ideas, you know.
Right, right. Well, it has to be on that level where people refuse to sell it in that regard, no matter how much they're offered, or the people who are going out and hunting for it. It has to be a change in people's, you know, perception about these things, I think, mentally, for it to turn
around. Well, just think what the oil companies are willing to pay to keep that stuff quiet.
Sure,
so,
sure.
Let's say Monsanto gets the information, then they can sell it. They can blackmail the oil companies, you know.
Yeah.
To keep it quiet.
So, William, before we wrap things up here, tell us when's your next book out to do? I heard you're working on a new one, right?
Well, I'm writing one on I discovered in 1980, I discovered that there was a ancient Minoan colony sponsored by the Egyptian pharaoh in this ranch near me. And I spent about over 30 years researching this, and the book is almost done, but I can't get the software. Like I say, the software is giving me a problem. I don't know enough about it. If I had the talents of my son and my ability of my son, I could have this book out a long time ago. But right now, I've been held up for months because of the software limitations, and I now have the software that I need to get it done if I can just figure out how to use it. So it's all comes down to that. The book's basically written, and it's got a lot of documentation. It's really going to be a mind blower for the archaeological community because, you know, this is hard facts, and it's irrefutable information that these Egyptians came here and colonized in around 1626-27 BC. And in New Mexico.
Interesting.
And they're basically refugees from the island of Santorini, what was originally called Calista, and what you might know as Thera. When the volcano started to erupt, they had to evacuate.
Right.
Actually, they were backed by the Egyptians and sent over here to claim the territory in the name of the Egyptian pharaoh, which they did.
Well, that sounds interesting. Yeah. Maybe we can have you back here, William, at some point to talk more about that. That's a whole 2-hour show in itself right there.
I think so. When I get the book out, it'll be interesting to see what the reaction is, you know, because it's factual. You know, I deciphered a stone called the Jed Festival Stone, and I deciphered it, and it's just covered with hieroglyphics and other Egyptian writings, and also it's got three kinds of hieroglyphs, and in addition, it also has something called Tifinagh, which is obtained by the Libyans from the Norse, and also some Libyan writing on it. So it's got a lot of information, and then I found more and more and more stuff all over the place. There's a lot of Norse stuff here, for example.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of people getting into these kinds of subjects now, and they find cultural references all over the place in North America and America specifically. It's very interesting, actually. There's quite a few good people doing work on this, actually.
Yeah, it's starting to look bad for the archaeologists.
That's right. Well, all right. Well, we'll see if we can pick that up at another time then, William. But in the meantime, we say thank you for your time and for talking with us, different perspective on these topics, something to think about. We'll have the links up on our website for the books and to your website as well. So check out redicemembers.com and redicecreations.com. But thanks for your time today, William. I appreciate it.
Well, Henrik, it's really been enjoyable, and I really liked your frame of mind and your openness, and the way you interviewed me was very nice.
Thank you.
I thank you very much.
We have some great shows coming up with Robert Felix, Sophia Smallstorm, John King, William Mullen, Kong Pop Yu Yen, Karen Hughes, and Barbara Peterson. Thank you to all our members, and my thanks to the crew at Red Ice, as always, for their hard work. We'll be back in just a couple of days. Have a great weekend, everybody. Take care, stay cool, and we'll talk to you later.